This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Quick heads up here at the top. I am speaking to a pissed off actor who's on strike in this episode. And she's got words for people. Four letter words. You've been warned. Leah Delaria may not be able to work very much right now, but she's got a whole lot of jobs.
I'm an actor, a stand-up comic, a writer, a singer.
How long have you been in SAG-AFTRA?
I've been in SAG-AFTRA since 1993. You had to be in SAG in order to do the Arsenio Hall show.
Some people think that my next guest is too controversial for TV. She's a lesbian stand-up comedian. Yeah.
So when I was the first openly gay comic on a television in America, that's how I got my SAG card.
It's great to be here because it's the 1990s and it's hip to be queer and I'm a big dyke. Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
You know, I just rewatched that appearance because it is so seminal. And the only thing I could keep thinking was like, oh, my God, they put so much makeup on her.
Oh, my God, they put so much makeup on me. And at that time, I didn't have the wherewithal or the I didn't know I could say no.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Leah is one of those people you'd recognize on the street, but you might not know why. She's performed on Broadway. She's got an amazing voice. But she's always made a chunk of her living as a TV actor with a lot of under five roles, as in under five lines. She's been on Matlock, Law & Order, Broad City.
You live in New York City 5 years. You got bed bugs. Well, I do have some good news. I can't guarantee that I can get them out. However, I can guarantee that I can't.
So when the Screen Actors Guild walked out of negotiations with Hollywood Studios last week, Leah went looking for a picket line. Are you hyped for the strike?
So hyped.
Really?
Yes. This inequity in the streaming services and the pay that we get has been up my butt for 10 years.
If you want to know why actors are striking, Leah's a pretty good person to ask. Because after doing all those walk-on roles, she got cast as a recurring character in Orange is the New Black. Over the course of 6 seasons, Leah had this inside look at the dawn of the streaming era. What were you expecting out of that gig?
Well, we didn't know what to expect out of that gig because it hadn't been done before, if you know what I mean. It was brand new, this medium, this streaming media. I mean, it was like, I remember when my manager said it's for Netflix, I was like, you mean the envelopes that come to your door with movies in them? You know what I mean? We all said that.
It did not take long for Leah to figure out that she had lucked into an unexpected hit. She felt like a Jonas brother. She'd get off a plane and there would be people waiting for her with signs, screaming. Still, it took 4 seasons for her to get promoted to a series regular.
We were the horse that Netflix rode in on, as people say. At one point, a Netflix executive said to me that we were watched by more people than all the other shows on Netflix combined. That was said to me.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Was there a moment you got mad about all this?
Oh, yeah. It was when we were at a party. It was at Ted
Sarandos, the guy who's in charge of Netflix.
Yeah. The head of Netflix, whose salary is over $22 million a year. Said that we were more popular than Game of Thrones. And all of us kind of looked at each other at that point. That was a moment. That was an aha moment for a lot of the actors on the show.
What were you kind of saying to each other with your eyes in that moment?
Why aren't we getting that money? Why are we not getting that money? You know, to him, it was a big deal to beat HBO, but he certainly wasn't paying us what people get paid on HBO.
To be clear, Leah did make money as an Orange is the New Black cast member. She knows she's privileged, but she had castmates who were forced to make different choices. One kept up her yoga business, another one tended bar, another worked as a nurse. Now, Leah says, she's ready to fight. Do you think the studios really understand how actors are feeling right now?
Of course they understand it, but they don't give a fuck.
Today on the show, how Hollywood got blindsided by a double strike. First the writers, now the actors. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
To dig a little deeper into this double strike, I called up Alyssa Wilkinson, a senior correspondent over at Vox. She writes about entertainment. I asked her if she could explain the motivation behind the strikes in the simplest terms possible. Her response was one word, technology.
There's kind of two sides to this, two technologies. One is one that has very firmly already arrived, and one is one that's kind of just on the horizon. So the first one is streaming. We're all very familiar with streaming, of course.
Yes.
And what we might not remember is that about 15 years ago, kind of just as streaming was starting to appear on the horizon, the feeling was kind of like, who's going to want to watch TV on their computer, right?
Turns out a lot of us.
But a lot of the unions didn't quite catch how big of a deal streaming would be. And so they didn't negotiate for residuals, which are kind of like royalties that are paid to people who make stuff for Hollywood. They didn't negotiate to have them on the same level as what someone might get if their show is watched on cable.
So that's a big oops.
And it's the kind of thing that the unions are very aware they don't want to happen again, and also very aware that they've been suffering the consequences. It's like extremely low, the kind of income that they earn from streaming TV shows and movies, which is, of course, everything now. So that's the one that, you know, is kind of present with us that we're all familiar with. The one that's on the horizon is AI. And certainly over the past year, I think most of us have become more aware of the capabilities of AI and also how those capabilities are evolving super quickly. For the writers, they understood that AI could sort of threaten to replace their jobs. That's an even bigger deal for SAG-AFTRA. Actors know that their performances that they've given can be replicated by computers. And furthermore, that voice performances also can be replicated by computers, and that AI is going to make all of this super simple, and it will probably be used to eliminate jobs for many actors unless they kind of put their foot down and say, if you want to work with us, you have to guarantee that you're actually going to hire us and not just take our likenesses and our voices and then use them without our consent and without paying us in perpetuity throughout the universe, which it turns out is basically what the AMPTP is arguing for.
The AMPTP is the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. They're a trade organization made up not of people, but of major studios and production companies. Think Disney, Warner Brothers, Netflix. They're on the other side of the bargaining table for both the actors and the screenwriters. And the last time they were facing a double strike was in 1960.
It's kind of a funny story. So at the time, what they were both bargaining for were residuals when a movie that they worked on was sold to a TV network, which would then broadcast it and earn money from ads.
This sounds kind of familiar, like the streaming thing.
Uh-huh, exactly. And again, it was technology, right? TV in 1960 was still kind of a newish thing. It was just, people were kind of just becoming alive to how big of a force this really was going to be. And the writers had gone on strike over this in January of 1960, and the actors joined them in March. SAG was led at the time by an actor named Ronald Reagan. And Reagan was a very effective negotiator and politician, even in 1960. And so he also was quite the labor activist on SAG's behalf at the time. And they got what they were asking for the most part. There were some compromises made, but the residuals were bargained for, and the writers eventually got theirs too. So sometimes the double nature of the strike, because that so firmly shuts down any production, and because actors have so much visibility, especially compared to writers, there's a real effectiveness to that that might sort of be a multiplier on what a single strike can be.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there are any lessons from 1960 for the strikers this time around.
I mean, there's a couple reasons that this particular strike in 2023 is really, really different from that one. One of them is that there's just a lot more content out there that people could be watching. And like reality TV exists, you know, all these kinds of things that just are newer innovations. And so it will take longer for people to notice the effect of the strike. And you sometimes need the consumer to take notice and the investors and shareholders especially to take notice of the effect before things start changing.
So you're saying I'm going to have to miss my TV shows for a bit.
You're already going to miss your TV shows, honestly. So I don't think a lot of people know this, but most productions have been shut down for a while because the Writers Guild has been very strategic about their picket lines and very, very organized. And crews generally refuse to cross picket lines. So I believe the number is something like 80% of productions in the U.S. have already been shut down. So your show is probably already delayed.
Can you just give me a TikTok of how negotiations broke down with the actors in particular?
It started to seem like it was becoming more of a possibility in the months leading up to first the writers' contract expiring in late April and the writers beginning their strike. You started to hear SAG-AFTRA in particular talking about AI. They were really worried about AI, and they should be. AI arguably is more of a threat to SAG-AFTRA than even the WGA.
AI is more of a threat to actors because in some ways the fight's more personal. The idea that a movie studio could photocopy your face or voice and make content without you, it's alarming. And it's even more alarming when you consider that the vast majority of SAG-AFTRA's members aren't making a whole lot of money.
Most actors are basically just getting by. They're not gonna be stars or millionaires. Those people could encounter a situation with AI where they're paid for their likeness. This is the proposal that the AMPTP brought to SAG-AFTRA, according to the Guild, that they would be paid a day rate, like one day, which is like a few hundred dollars tops, to be scanned, acting, doing stuff, and then their likeness would be used to generate background actors in the future. So whereas if you watch an episode of Friends and you see people sitting in the background at tables drinking coffee, those are humans doing that. But in the future, they may not be humans. They may be replications of humans who were captured 30 years earlier. And this already happens all the time. A lot of times, like a crowd scene, if you look very closely, is actually 20 people replicated across the screen a bunch of times.
You've said that you realized a few weeks or months back that AI was becoming the sticking point. How did you realize that? Like, was there a moment?
I saw some chatter. This is always how these things happen. You see some chatter between actors on Twitter, right? Or you see SAG-AFTRA members kind of talking to the press, maybe anonymously, about being worried about this. I was myself talking to a very famous actor very, very famous actor in the back room at a theater in early spring. And I was, we were talking about the strike, and he was like, I don't see what the problem would ever be. And I said, well, they have hours of you that they can just feed to a machine and then they never need you again. And, you know, you could sort of see a light bulb go on. It's just not the kind of thing that comes up every day for people who act for a living.
Oh, my gosh. You activated a famous person.
I did. I did. Well, more than one, but he sort of stuck out in my mind.
And that man was Tom Cruise. No.
I've never spoken to Tom Cruise directly. No, but it is someone everyone would know. So you could see SAG-AFTRA getting worried about this, and there was this hope that, you know, well, we'll come to a decision. You know, nobody wants a strike. We're just exiting this, like, really bad pandemic economic system for film and TV production. Like, everybody wants to be working.
Yeah, COVID's kind of looming over all of this.
That's right. Yes. And COVID was very expensive. You know, even if you could keep your movie or TV production running, you needed to have all these extra people to make sure that actors were safe on set. And so that's still very, very recent in most people's minds.
Just before the strike, this article came out in the trade magazine Deadline, and it laid out the studio's perspective on negotiations and a strike. Can you tell me about it and how it resonated in Hollywood?
So this Deadline article was wild to read because the article basically was about the WGA strike. And they said some anonymous studio executive said to the reporter that, you know, they're not planning on returning to the bargaining table with the Writers Guild until October, and that the end game is to, like, basically have them lose their homes and their apartments and come crawling back to us asking for work.
The language in this article is just gross. Like, one CEO is quoted as saying, we're going to let it bleed out. And you're like, what?
Yeah. So one way also to think about this is that there is more of a sense of being tech companies these days in Hollywood than of being movie studios. You know, some of them literally are tech companies. Apple, Amazon, Netflix are tech companies, and the big studios have kind of pivoted themselves in that direction as well, whether it's Disney or Warner Brothers Discovery or whatever. And this is the language of tech companies. You know, you kind of bleed your opponent out and then you buy them or something like that. So that's what it sounded like to me. And it also sounded like kind of an ill-advised attempt to warn SAG-AFTRA that we'll do the same to you. And from writers and actors on Twitter, you saw some funny reactions where they were like, look, you already pay us pennies and we all have second and third jobs to begin with. You know, you're not going to freeze us out as easily as you think. You know, we'll see, I guess, what happens. But, you know, if you couple that Deadline article with Bob Iger's remarks the next morning on TV, he's the CEO of Disney, and he was saying that he just thought the demands were very unreasonable and unrealistic.
We managed as an industry to negotiate a very good deal with the Directors Guild that reflects the value that the directors contribute to this great business. We wanted to do the same thing with the writers, and we'd like to do the same thing with the actors. There's a level of expectation that they have that is just not realistic, and they are adding to a set of challenges that this business is already...
You know, that there's a kind of effort to say that the writers and the actors are just greedy, and I think one of the stranger things, or maybe more serendipitous things that have happened in this whole process, is that I believe 2 days after the writers' contract expired and they went on strike, details came out about CEO executive pay and how it's, you know, $26 million, $50 million. But I think for writers and actors, it feels very obvious that if we create the product that's making you so much money that you get paid that much money, then we should perhaps get part of that and not be having to work second and third jobs.
Yeah, my favorite response came from actor Ron Perlman, who did this TikTok where he was basically like, Bob Iger, we know where you live. Like, it was just, it was very menacing.
There's a lot of ways to lose your house. You wish that on people. You wish that families starve while you're making $27 fucking million a year for creating nothing. Be careful, motherfucker. Be really careful.
It really, I mean, I would not want to tick off Ron Perlman. I think he actually deleted it at some point, but it very much lives on the internet. But I mean, you know, it's one thing to kind of make a bunch of writers mad at you and they write clever signs. But boy, when you get actors in the mix, like they're ready for this moment, right? They are ready for their close up and they are going to make the most of it.
After the break, just what are the studios thinking here?
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen. And her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
I do want to take just a bit of our time and consider the strike from the studio's perspective,
mm-hmm.
because the entertainment industry is not doing great right now.
No. It certainly isn't.
How would you quantify that or characterize that?
So one good example here is that the budgets of blockbuster movies have ballooned drastically, while also squeezing out the kind of mid-budget movies that you might see if you're thinking of like the great movies of the 90s, right? So where they're not They're not spending 100 or 200 million on them. They're spending 50 or 30 or something like that. The bigger budget movies are designed to appeal globally. So the idea is we make this huge budget superhero movie that kind of we think or we know has built-in appeal and is going to make a baseline profit. And we're also going to ship it across the world and everybody's going to be into it. And because those movies are kind of designed that way, they do make a lot of money, or they were until very recently. And what it feels like we're starting to see is fatigue around that. Ordinary people not wanting to have to see 26 movies and 3 TV shows in order to understand what's going on in this one movie.
Yeah, I went to Mission Impossible this weekend, and before the movie started, there was this little statement from Tom Cruise, like, thank you for being here. I'm so glad you came to the theater. And I was like, what is happening?
Yeah, Tom Cruise is a big theater booster, and no wonder. I mean, his movies do extremely well at the theater, and honestly, part of the reason the Mission Impossible movies do so well is that you barely have to know what the plot is going in, right? That's not the movie. The movie is stunts. That's why you're there. I love them. I think they're terrific. But so that's like one choice that really has driven the movie industry in the last 23 years. And when you think about it, if you spend $200 million on a movie, there's still kind of a cap on how much profit you can make off of that. So that's one reason. Another is the pivot towards streaming as the place that content is going to mostly be. And so people feel like, oh, I don't need to go to the movies to see a movie. I'll just watch it when it's on my streamer in 2.5 weeks that I already pay for. But again, I'm no math genius, but it doesn't cost a lot to subscribe to a streamer. And it's far less than the cost of one movie ticket.
Well, and now I log on to streaming services and sometimes shows are just gone.
Yes.
So.
Yes. So Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery and several of these companies have been pulling back content off their platforms. And sometimes shows that just concluded, they're just removing them entirely. And there's sort of a complicated economics to that. But basically, they get a tax write-off. And then sometimes they license them to these freebie kinds of platforms that are basically just TV with ads, which we, you know, those of us who are old enough to remember watching TV with ads, you know, those streamers exist now. So, yeah, obviously something didn't work out the way that everyone was hoping.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing that someone like Bob Iger has the moral high ground here, but it does seem like something's fundamentally broken. Is anyone trying to fix that? Because I don't think these negotiations can. Like, the negotiations are about money, but it seems like there's a bigger ask here, which is like, let's clean up this mess.
Right. Right. And really, the question is, once you've kind of opened Pandora's box, can you stuff everything back into it and close it? Right. And in Hollywood, we've kind of been at this point before. So there was a moment in kind of the late 1950s into the 1960s where TV was starting to cut into film revenue, and people were very worried about this. They, you know, they talked about it a lot, that TV is going to kill movies. And the studios were turning out these big, bloated, like biblical epics, musicals, historical epics, things that were just very expensive to make, and they weren't making the money back on them at the box office. And what happened immediately after that was the birth of New Hollywood, which is sort of these lean kind of youth culture movies that were shot very cheaply. We can think of like, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, right? Or Easy Riders or The Graduate or movies of that era, where we still watch them and think of them as great works of cinema. But part of the reason they were great works of cinema was that they were able to take some risks. And in some cases, they took risks without asking permission. The question right now, I think, is whether we're too far down the path to do that, or whether we have an economics that will support a new generation of creators, and whether people are going to flock to risky movies the way that they used to.
You know, as I was getting ready for this interview, I noticed that you have been writing about looming technological changes in Hollywood for years. Like, I found an article you did in 2020 that looked at the same, some of the same things Hollywood is striking over now, like AI.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you framed what was going on as a kind of existential threat.
Yes. Yes. I have an academic background in computer science, and I used to be a coder. So some of this stuff is just a little less scary to me. But when I wrote that article, what had happened, and this is very interesting to me, there's a series of AI programs that were being written at the time and shopped around to studios that would basically eat a script and then spit out kind of like how much it might make. So it basically would just look at a screenplay and say what it thought it would make, and then you could plug in different stars to different roles, and it would like approximate the what the budget should be and what your profits would be. And ironically, this is an AI that basically would sort of replace studio executives. Like, that's their job, is to greenlight things. And this just disturbed me on a lot of levels, one of which is the same problem that comes up every time we talk about AI, which is that it's going to be trained on historical data. And the historical data in Hollywood is very biased toward a certain kind of entertainment made by a certain kind of person, which is to say, throughout Hollywood history, it's almost always been sort of white guys from privileged backgrounds. And so you would wind up seeing a series of decisions kind of reinforced by existing historical data. And that's the same thing that would happen with performances. I mean, if you just think about it, if you were to create an AI that was going to do a lot of the background work and it's being trained on existing performances, and that is going to slam the door shut on what we've seen really only over the last maybe 10 years, which is a conscious effort to widen the door and let more people in. And I think we could end up in a position where Hollywood regresses to what it was, you know, 30 years ago.
I mean, you've said previously that CEOs of the studios are basically counting on audiences not caring about this. Like, just being like, eh, sure.
Yeah. A lot of people I talk to will say, oh, I hate watching computer-generated performances. Or, you know, oh, I've seen what a ChatGPT can do. Like, I don't want to watch that. And I say, well, you know, we tend to think of the best stuff when we're trying to compare those things. But really, most of what's produced right now is done hastily, with under-resourced, kind of sloppily, and you might not notice the difference. And even if you do, I do think that they're betting on the idea that you won't care that much. You know, the basic attitude of a franchise-driven Hollywood is that you'll just be happy if you see your favorite people on screen or your favorite characters, and that having like a good plot or a great script or something like that just doesn't really matter. And I don't think that has to be true, but I definitely think that some of the high-up executives think that way.
Alyssa, I'm super grateful for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Alyssa Wilkinson is a senior correspondent at Vox. And Leah Delaria, who you heard at the top of the show, she's an actor, comedian, musician, and three-time SAG Award winner. Have you thought about what you'd put on like a sign?
Oh, this, I was thinking I was going to put, this SAG fag needs a residual hike dike.
Just to clarify, Slate staff journalists like me and Vox's staff, like Alyssa, we're all part of the Writers Guild of America. We are not striking, though. It's just the television and screenwriters. We are not covered under their contract. All right, that's the show. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Madeline Ducharme, and Anna Phillips. We are led by Alicia Montgomery with a little help from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here tomorrow.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.